This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 6 declared candidates and counting. No, that's not presidential candidates. It's the number of hats in the ring to succeed Kofi Annan as Secretary General of the United Nations. His second term expires at the end of this year, and the UN is already in the process of making a decision. And campaigning is underway. While none of the candidates is running TV ads, yet, sophisticated websites trumpet the skills of several of the hopefuls. A straw poll was conducted earlier this summer with 2 more test ballots set for this month. At the moment, the UN finds itself at the center of events in the Middle East, in Sudan, and the nuclear standoff with Iran. The job of Secretary General, though, may be the most difficult and least defined in the world. Chief Administrative Officer is how the UN Charter describes it, but as recent Secretaries General have shown from their international travels, this is hardly a desk job. Today, a look at the unusual process and the candidates and what it is that the secretary does and doesn't do. But first, later in the program, Motley Fool David Gardner makes one of his regular visits to discuss investments and the stock market. But first, the battle to be the next Secretary General of the United Nations. Whoever's selected will become globally famous, but none of those mentioned for the job is exactly a household name at the moment. All right, Tony Blair and Bill Clinton have denied any interest. If you have any questions about who they are, who they represent, and the eventual choice, what that will say about the United Nations today, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. We begin with Mark Turner, who covers the United Nations for the Financial Times. He's at our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Is this public jockeying to replace Kofi Annan? Is that seemly for this position?
Well, I don't know about seemly or not seemly. It's certainly relatively unusual. There's certainly been a sense of contenders out there before, but I think this year the process has been a little bit more high profile than traditional. There's been quite a push from the countries of the General Assembly, who don't normally have much of a say in who becomes Secretary General, to try and open this process up a little bit. But it all started when the Thai Deputy Prime Minister, Sirikit Sathirathai, began a pretty major campaign around the region, secured the support of Southeast Asian countries, and that basically set the tone for other candidates to who wanted to put their hat in the ring to really come out with a pretty public campaign. So, seemly or not seemly, I don't know. People probably welcome it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's different from the norm, but
it's interesting. There's sort of this informal rotation. Various parts of the world get the possibility of having the next Secretary General. Is it right that everybody believes it's Asia's turn this time around?
It's beginning to look that way. There was... the U.S. has been the most sort of prominent country to try and fight against that sense of it's Asia's turn. Part of the deal, though, when Kofi Annan became Secretary General for the second time, that meant that there had been an African Secretary General 3 terms in a row, was that they got Asia's support in return for Asia getting an agreement to get it next time. So most countries seem to have rallied around that. Eastern Europe has said, well, we've never had one, so it should be our turn as well. But to be honest, that seems to be slipping away a little bit now.
When you say, Africa got the votes from Asia last time, this horse swapping, and this horse swapping happened 8 years ago. People remember that?
Sure. Was it 8 years ago? I mean, Kofi Annan has had 2 terms,
yes.
And I guess it was getting the second term that there was a lot of the... But no, people certainly remember. UN diplomats and UN civil servants have long memories. We in the media kind of tend to think in terms of a couple of days. They think in terms of a couple of decades. So it's a different attitude, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And as all of this goes on, I'm assuming most of it goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, one of your commentators earlier, I think it was Bill Lewis, was saying it mm-hmm. was a little more transparent than the selection of the Pope and a little less than the President. Well, I don't know if it's that much more transparent than the selection of the Pope. One of the standard kind of ways of saying it's described as the papal enclave, but without the smoke. So, it is done behind closed doors. It's dominated by the 5 permanent members of the Security Council, but there has been a pretty strong bid by other countries to open the process up a little bit. And it's happened a slight bit, but to be honest, not that much. It's still pretty obscure.
Explain the process for us. They're having these straw polls, but it all leads up to a vote in the Security Council.
Yeah, to be honest, the processes, they kind of make it up as they go along. They're guided by previous processes, but each one is different. They had a straw poll, and they're going to have another one where everybody gives an encourage, a discourage, or a no opinion. No red cards, though, as in past straw polls, veto-wielding members of the Security Council have, you know, had a special... It's been indicated what their opinion was. Mm-hmm. This time, at least for the next straw poll, the idea is that they don't want to do that. So, yeah, that's where we are, basically. Then there may be another one on the 28th. That's not clear either. What's going to come out of the 14th, no one really knows. There were four candidates who were voted on last time. It looked actually for a while as though nobody else was going to come out. It's always seen as the kiss of death to come out a little bit too early. But mm-hmm. the Prince Zayed of Jordan, kind of fondly known as the petit prince around UN, came out. And I think everyone was pretty pleased because it kind of injected a new dynamism into the whole thing. And now it might be easier, depending on how countries vote, to get a sense of a trend. If some candidates get less votes than they did last time, it's a pretty clear indication that they're not going to get it, and then it'll be expected that they politely stand aside and maybe open the field up for new people still waiting in the wings.
Well, let's find out who some of these candidates are. Joining us here in Studio 3A in Washington is Christine Chen, senior editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. In June, she put together a website for foreign policy handicapping some of the early leaders in the race to replace Kofi Annan. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Now, a couple of months have passed since you put that website up. So tell us today, who do you think is the leading candidate, at least of those declared?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. You know, this entrance of Prince Zayed Al Hussein this week kind of throws everything into a new dynamic. He's pretty popular. People like him a lot.
Mm-hmm. And Jordan is, of course, part of Asia.
Jordan is technically part of Asia in the UN groupings of continents and countries, yes.
Mm-hmm. And who are the others that look prominent, at least?
Well, the other ones who've officially declared their candidacies are Ban Ki-moon of South Korea. He's currently the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and he has worked a lot on North Korea, South Korea issues, on nukes in mm-hmm. North Korea, that type of thing. Another official candidate is Jayantha Dhanapala, who is from Sri Lanka, and he is the senior advisor to the president of Sri Lanka. And he was considered a very early favorite. However, things have fallen apart a little bit in Sri Lanka. The civil war is intensifying. Things are getting worse. And he has been a big part of that peace process there. Mm-hmm. So the hairier things are over there, the less his chances are of getting this post. Then there is, of course, as Mark mentioned, Surakirt Sirithai from Thailand. He's the deputy prime minister. And he was considered an early favorite, but he might actually be handicapped by the fact that he threw himself into the race too early and too prominently. He does have the backing of ASEAN nations.
Association of Southeast Asian
exactly.
Nations.
Exactly. And, you know, another problem with him is that he's very closely allied with the Prime Minister of Thailand, who is not necessarily the most prominent or popular figure internationally, partially because it's perceived that he has cracked down on Muslims in Thailand in the south.
Mark Turner mentioned Eastern Europe.
Eastern Europe, there are a couple of unofficial candidates, names that have been bandied about. One is the president of Latvia. Her name is Vaira Vike Freiberga, and she's sort of the strongest woman candidate out there, although she's not officially a candidate. There's also the former president of Poland, Aleksander Kwasniewski. But the big thing about any of the Eastern European countries is that Russia, of course, as a permanent member of the Security Council, has veto power. And Russia really doesn't want anyone who used to be part of the Soviet bloc to actually hold the reins at the UN.
Also, that old Europe, new Europe split. France might not be too thrilled with a Polish nominee either, at least at this juncture. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Jerry. Jerry's calling us from here in Washington, D.C.
Yes. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I'm calling because I've noticed for the last year that it would be high time for a woman to be the Secretary General of the UN after 61 years, and I find it incredible that nobody is talking about any serious candidate, and all of that boils down to it is unjust. It is unjust. And why is this relevant? Because, of course, more than 50% of the people of the world are women, and after 61 years, you would think that they would be promoting women. There are 8 Millennium Development Goals. There are 8 Millennium Development Goals at the UN, and one of them is gender equity. Mm-hmm. Within the UN itself, they do not practice gender equity. It is top-heavy with men in high positions, and the point of that is that they end up not treating women fairly within the UN at times, and I have personal experiences. I could relate to that effect. Mm-hmm. So this is my whole bottom line point. It's crying out for justice that the next person as Secretary General should be a woman. But are you going to get status quo men who have had power from the beginning of time to give it up?
Interestingly, it was John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, who made that point as well. Mark Turner, we just heard from Christine Chen about one possible woman candidate from the Baltic states. There are some others who may come into this.
Well, it's the latest rumor that everybody's talking about is the Singaporean ambassador to the U.S., Chan Heng Chi, which I think Time magazine raised her name recently as a Washington favorite, although putting anyone as a Washington favorite could be the kiss of death for any candidate. It's funny that the caller talked about justice. I think most people would agree that it is time for a woman. Kofi Annan also called for a woman. But the choice of the Secretary General is nothing to do with justice, unfortunately. It's to do with a backdoor deal between the most powerful nations. Now, Asia, I think there's been a certain amount of disappointment that the Asian governments, and if you want to be a candidate, you have to have a government put your name forward, haven't put forward the names of any women. So to a certain degree, the people to complain to are the Asian governments, and it would be up to the citizens in those countries to convince their governments to back a woman. But I think there's a lot of feeling that it should be a woman, but I certainly wouldn't bet on that at the moment.
Jerry, thanks very much for the call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls. Who will be the next Secretary General of the United Nations? What does it say about the job and about the United Nations? I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The new Secretary General of the United Nations, whoever that may be, will take over at the start of next year. Today we're talking about some of the names that have appeared as possible candidates for the position in a few minutes. More on what kind of job they may face. Our guests are Mark Turner, the United Nations correspondent for the Financial Times, and Christine Chen, senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine, who wrote an article at the magazine's website called The List, Who Wants to Lead the United Nations? Of course, you're welcome to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And particularly if you have questions about the challenges that the new Secretary General may be facing. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Lakshmi. Lakshmi is with us from San Jose.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, I didn't hear that journalist mentioning Mr. Shashi Tharoor's name. Has he dropped out of the race?
And Christine Chen.
No, he has not at all. Shashi Tharoor, of course, is the communications head of the UN, and he is from India. India has put his name forward. He's very well-liked, very well-respected, and certainly excellent at public diplomacy. And in the straw poll that was conducted in July, he did very, very well. Traditionally, the Secretary General of the UN has not come from a major country, partially because they tend to come from non-aligned smaller countries.
Isn't there sort of an unwritten rule, for example, he or she cannot come from one of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council?
Yes, that's pretty much the case, which is why all this talk about Tony Blair or Bill Clinton is just, speculation for fun. But Shashi Tharoor, India, of course, is not in the Security Council. China, however, is. And China is very important in terms of who they choose to back. They haven't said anything about Tharoor's eligibility or what they think of him. They may do very well to back him, but however, they're obviously very allied with Pakistan, and Pakistan could have issues with that.
Although there is almost a conspiracy theory that since you can't have a Secretary General from a country with a permanent seat on the Security Council, and since India wants a permanent seat on the Security Council, actually Pakistan could achieve a goal by seeing an Indian Secretary General, because that would basically...
That's very devious there, Mark.
Well, that's what they do. It's a deviousness in diplomacy. Although, to be honest, Shashi Tharoor's candidacy, we'll see. He is an incredibly accomplished self-publicist, but there is a certain sense of more form than substance, at least some comments by a group of high-placed commentators that were at one of his speeches yesterday. So we'll see. He's very polished, but I don't know. I don't think we'll see.
Lakshmi, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Is it generally the case, who knows what's going to happen this time, there haven't been all that many of these elections, but is it generally the case, Christine, that the successful candidate will emerge rather later in the game?
Yeah, that's very true. It's definitely possible that whoever gets it is someone we may not even have heard of. The very first Secretary General was a Norwegian who was actually head of the General Assembly. He didn't want the post. He actively said, "I don't want it," but he got it anyway. Mm-hmm. So who knows?
Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Christine Chen is a senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine. She wrote The List, Who Wants to Lead the United Nations, for the Foreign Policy website, which handicapped some of the candidates who might be replacing Kofi Annan. Now let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Tony. Tony's with us from Oxford in Kansas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And my question was, who or what exactly qualifies somebody to become Secretary of the UN? I mean, I heard the comment about Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, and I heard the explanation why they weren't eligible.
Mm-hmm.
But what background does somebody have to have, or would you like to see them have, before they can even be nominated? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Tony, thanks very much. Is there any, you have to be 35 years old and born a naturalized U.S. citizen?
There was some discussion of that. To be honest, I take a kind of more cynical view. Basically, the qualification to become the Secretary General is that you're not objected to by the US, China, Russia, or the Europeans, and that's about as far as it goes. But if I want to be slightly less cynical, there's basically two things that a Secretary General is: Secretary and General. And the Secretary side of it is basically, especially in the wake of all sorts of scandals and problems with management, people are looking for an accomplished manager, i.e. somebody who has the guts to hire and fire, to put people in the right place, in the right job, and so forth. Something that Kofi Annan hasn't been particularly good at doing. The other part of the job is being the world's top diplomat, something Kofi Annan has been considerably better at doing, although people will question some of his decisions. And so that's why it is a very difficult job, because to get both of that in one person is normally rare. You're either an arch diplomat or you're an excellent manager. There have been a lot of discussion about whether there should in fact be a ticket, one being the diplomat, one being the manager, the CEO and the COO kind of model. Though people haven't been running as a ticket yet, we might be see that begin to emerge as the process goes on.
Well, joining us now is Paul Kennedy, professor of international history at Yale University. His latest book is The Parliament of Man, The Past, Present, and Future of the United Nations. And he joins us from studios on the Yale campus in New Haven, Connecticut. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're talking about qualifications. What's actually involved in the SG's job, and what skills are necessary?
Well, here's by description in a chart of a chief administrative officer of the United Nations. He serves all of the other organs. The Secretariat itself is an organ. He is not, like that French farce, the servant of two masters. He's the servant of a large number. But in particular, he and the Secretariat are servants and serve the Security Council and the General Assembly. He also acts, as Mark said just before, as the number one diplomat of the international body, negotiator, and also has to be increasingly a manager because of the scrutiny which has been cast upon the operations of the personnel, recruitment, and other aspects of administration that, quite frankly, some of the diplomats would not be interested in handling.
Mm-hmm. Oil for food, I guess, is the phrase that comes up there.
Yes, it's a sort of messy business, so why not leave it to someone else? And then you discover later, to your alarm, that the someone else's perhaps didn't have a culture of the American or British civil service and got their hands dirty.
As the Secretary General, someone, certainly Kofi Annan, has used the bully pulpit, but I think we've also seen that the Secretary General does not exactly have a lot of resources of his own to marshal on any subject whatsoever.
No, he hasn't resources of his own. They all flow from the position and flow from him getting on, especially with the Security Council. The bully pulpit is, however, significant. All of the Secretary Generals, at least from Dag Hammarskjöld onwards, have felt obliged to speak for the general purposes and the general aims of the organization. So they are the ones most likely to invoke the wonderful language of the preamble to the Charter. On the other hand, they cannot just stop there with the rhetoric. They have to go and negotiate with very difficult regimes in Tehran or elsewhere. They have to keep on the good side of the five permanent veto members. They're very sensitive, Kofi especially, to criticisms from African countries that he pays insufficient attention to Africa, or the world body pays insufficient attention to Africa, or that if it pays attention to Africa, it's very patronizing and looking down its nose. So this is a job where it's a bit like, you know, that old Chinese saying, man who sits in the middle of road gets hit by traffic going in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Secretary General's job.
Let's get another caller in. This is Tom. Tom's calling us from Minneapolis.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I'm thinking about, with America being the most influential nation in the UN right now, and with the U.S. being seen by many, many people around the world as being anti-Muslim, I wonder what the likelihood is that we would get a Muslim person as the U.N. Secretary General. And with the work ahead for this post in the Middle East, wouldn't that be helpful and give the UN more credibility in that region?
Mark Turner, Prince Zayed of Jordan, the cousin of the current king, he has declared himself a candidate.
Yes, he has, and he is a Muslim, and that would start. I mean, he's partly basing his candidacy on being a bridge between the West and the Islamic world, partly because he's also very familiar with the West and is a moderate. And so, yeah, that could stand in his stead. There is a question whether he's Asian enough for the Asians, certainly that. But he also referred to the issue with the U.S. I mean, whoever becomes Secretary General, it is the possibly the toughest job, that basically the U.S. being the most powerful and most influential member, and in many ways, you know, the indispensable nation without which the U.N. can't accomplish anything, also is increasingly unpopular again. And anything that... So a Secretary General basically has to do things to keep the U.S. happy, but the closer he moves towards keeping the U.S. happy, the unhappier everybody else gets. So it's a very difficult position.
I wonder, Paul Kennedy, time for a Muslim? Is SG?
I think this Prince Zayed is a wonderful late dark horse, and surprisingly attractive, at least to me. He's educated at Cambridge, England, and in the U.S. He's obviously fluent. He's very influential in his own country, Jordan, which is an American ally. He will be regarded very, very favorably across the Arab world, not by the utter extremists, of course. And in fact, the United States could do a lot worse than quietly indicate support for him. The question in my mind, though, is whether China, which has essentially quietly told the other permanent members that since this is Asia, South Asia and East Asia's turn, and it will act as the big cousin or the big brother, will not come out in some opposition to a more distant and certainly less Asian than a Sri Lankan or a Thai candidate.
Mm. Tom, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can talk with wrong button. Drew. Drew's with us from Wichita in Kansas.
Hi, good afternoon. Excellent conversation. I wanted to go ahead and follow up on what the caller before just said, plus your first caller. With the conflicts that are going on, can somebody from the East or Near East be impartial, and is it required that they're impartial? And from the first caller, would a female, would a lady in that position, would she be able to deal with some of the governments that have either cultural or political biases against dealing with women.
Hmm. I wonder, Paul Kennedy, impartiality, is it that, or is it acceptability to the five permanent members?
Oh, it's meant to be both, of course, having your cake and eating it. It's interesting that Sashi, the Indian candidate, asked last week whether he would not act on behalf of India's interests, say, vis-a-vis a clash over Pakistan, said that he would be the United Nations Secretary General, not India's Secretary General. As with regard to gender, well, I think Mark was on the ball earlier. It would be really wonderful if there was a woman candidate who emerged from Asia, nominated by one of the Asian governments, and the problem is that none have been so nominated. Would a woman find it difficult to negotiate with more conservative cultural and cultural religious regimes? Perhaps yes, but I think the pressure would be upon those regimes rather than upon the Secretary General, who was female.
Mm. Drew, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're talking about the next Secretary General of the United Nations. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Peter's with us. Peter calling from West Haven in Connecticut.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to find out what the salary of the Secretary General is.
Well, are you thinking of applying for the job, Peter?
Not necessarily, but certainly wanted to have that question answered.
Mark Turner, how much does the Secretary General make?
You know what, for my shame, I'm not sure I could tell you exactly. It's sort of in the somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000. I think it's somewhere in the middle there. But I think it's about 150,000. But you know what, I don't know off the top of my head. I'm
Paul
sorry
Kennedy, is this something at your fingertips?
It's a bit higher than that. They were originally based on Swiss civil service rates. And as you can imagine, it's rather useful to be based on the Swiss currency rate. So mm-hmm. I don't
they based
know
it on the rate
either.
They based it on Swiss on the civil service of a country that is not a member.
Because they wanted a stable currency. Remember, there wasn't much going around. The dollar was far too strong in 1945. Everybody else was weak. Mm. So they just looked at, I believe this is right, the Swiss civil service scale. Because remember, they were not fixing just the Secretary General's salary, but those of the international secretariat which was being recruited.
Mm. Peter, good question. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And let's see if we can talk with it's another Peter. Peter calling from Berkeley.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for this great show. I wanted to say that I hope whoever the next Secretary General is has the courage not just to stick with the status quo, but to reach out to the people of the world everywhere and really lead a campaign not only to declare our common ethical ideals more explicitly, which is deeply needed in today's world, but also to set up a system of direct global taxation of the population everywhere.
This
would incredibly strengthen the international organization, obviously.
It might strengthen it in some ways.
It is a true supreme democratic global power that it needs. You know, Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution is so elegant and so succinct. And it prevents war among the states. It says, quote, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul Kennedy, I guess this gets to some of the things you wrote about in a recent op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, what the Secretary General can do and can't do.
Yes. Allow me to make two comments on Peter's really wonderful question here. First of all, if the Secretary General is going to be such an advocate for all of humanity and for the common man and woman, is it prudent for that person to declare himself to be before the vote is taken? How well would that be received in China, let alone in Russia? Secondly, the common taxation. Well, we've had a crack at this before, and a large number of people think it is a good idea. But then it runs contradictorily against the feelings of nation states, especially in this country, that it is government contributions which count and you do not want an independent flow of income. Whether the idea be an ingenious one of a very small tax upon international currency transactions or whatever, the U.S. Senate will come down firmly and say, no, no, we want to keep our hands around the neck of this organization, and we can do so when the money comes as granted from Congress.
I would agree with everything you just said. The global taxation thing is just one of these red cards to the American right, basically grounds for pushing the UN headquarters quietly into the East River. Although they've had a crack at it, the French and the Norwegians and the Brazilians have set up this global airline tax, and basically countries can opt into that. Just more broadly on who, you know, whether you are stand
up
for moral rights.
And very quickly, if you could.
Okay, well, the first thing I ever got told when I came to the UN is that the Secretary General is no Ralph Nader, and I guess there's some truth to that.
All right. Mark Turner of the Financial Times, who covers the United Nations, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Paul Kennedy, Professor of International History at Yale. His book, The Parliament of Man, The Past, Present, and Future of the United Nations. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.